a follow-up on yesterday's session, because I'm going to start with by showing a couple of stories about people who made changes to protect the environment. And then I'm going to go on and show clips from one piece about Native American views here, particularly in Washington State, of the environment. But I want to start out with a clip from a film called For Earth's Sake, which is a biography of David Brower, a famous environmentalist who many of you may have heard of, who really built the Sierra Club from when he took over a small hiking society of about 5,000 people. He left it the biggest environmental organization in the United States. He was then the founder of another organization, Friends of the Earth, and after that, of the Earth Island Institute, the organization whose t-shirt I'm wearing here. And I had the opportunity to produce this biography of David Brower for PBS for Earth Day 1990, for the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. And I think it's, for me, one of the great delights of my life as a filmmaker, because few filmmakers, I think, get to tell on film the story of their personal hero. But for me, David Brower has been, was, I think, a real personal hero. I was first aware of him when I was about 14 years old, living in San Francisco, and first joining the Sierra Club and being active in hiking and backpacking in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and then on up through the environmental movement, which I was involved in. Dave Brower lived to be 88. He just died about a little over a year and a half ago, in November of 2000, and I had a chance to visit him in the hospital about a week before he died, and it was kind of a very moving thing for me. When I left, I said, "Geez, Dave. Well, I hope that, you know, the next time I see you, you'll be feeling good and back to your old activities and everything." And he looked me in the eye and he said, and I'll certainly always remember this, just kind of straight in the eye. He said, "I don't think that's in the cards, but it's been a great 88 years." And I think that's something that all of us, whether we live 88 years or 60 years or 100 years, want to be able to say that our life counted for something while we were on this planet. I think Dave's life counted for a lot. He was really responsible for such things as saving the Grand Canyon from power dams, really, I think, getting America to think about the importance of wilderness, the Wilderness Act, of conservation, and then later on kind of leading the way to think about other key issues of the environment, ranging from pollution to consumption and many, many others. But Dave Brower played a special role in this area here where we are today, and that's the part of the film that I want to show you. I don't know if they have this book in their bookstore, and I should have recommended it, and they should have it. It's called Encounters with the Archdruid. Has anybody read that book? Seen the book? Somebody has, okay. By John McPhee. And it's a story of David Brower, and it kind of looks at his life by taking him on three trips with three of his, quote, natural enemies. And the first of these natural enemies, so-called, that John McPhee takes David Brower on a hike with, is a fellow who's a geologist, a miner, who wants to open a copper mine right up on Cloudy Pass, near here, for the Kennecott Copper Corporation. And David Brower, of course, does not want to see a copper mine put up in the sort of looking like the Holden mine put up in near Cloudy Pass and Mirror Lake, and not Mirror Image Lake, I'm sorry. And so the story starts in Holden, and actually it follows the walk that they take up to Cloudy Pass and around, and the ways that they interact. And and this it takes place in 1969, but it goes back and looks at the work that Brower did to create the North Cascades National Park, which many of you have appreciated, and which, of course, encircles this area. Brower was the leading advocate for that park and worked on it really for about 12 years in a hard effort to get Congress to create the park. So that's what I'm going to show you is the story of the creation of North Cascades National Park. I wonder if we could pull down the shade in the back there.
I can't thank you. Take no one over here and scare.
This is Stehekin Landing, gateway to one of the most magnificent wilderness areas in the United States. Here, on a summer weekend in 1988, backpackers come by boat en route to the rugged trails of North Cascades National Park. Dave Brower arrives here too for a reunion with some of the people who worked hard to create the park 20 years earlier. It was a long effort.
You bring bad weather. I don't know why you're having to do this. No. I find you came here. You're raining all over us.
No, this is good weather. I don't like it dry and hot.
Back in 1956, Grant McConnell was a college professor who spent summers in Stehekin. Alarmed by the effects of mining and logging in the area, he took his concerns to David Brower.
It was not a difficult matter to persuade him that this place needed help.
Fresh from his dinosaur triumph, Brower suggested a film to show people what should be preserved. Then he brought his camera and his oldest sons to the North Cascades.
We used to always complain, my brother and I, because we were sort of pressed into service as models in these movies. We'd have to do the same routine three or four times to get it right.
Brower's boys and Grant McConnell's daughter starred as every child who might someday enjoy these mountains.
Up where the tree reaches high with the clouds, where the flower takes the summer wind with beauty, and the summer rain too. They will want to discover for themselves the wildness that the ages have made perfect.
I myself showed that film at least 100 times. And always had large audiences that were just enthralled with it. And I was always convinced that they were going right home to write their congressman.
The battle continued into the 60s. Timber and mining companies proved powerful adversaries. As government hearings on the issue approached, Brower looked for yet another way to persuade a reluctant Congress.
He wanted a book desperately, so he called me on the phone one day and said, "Harvey, you're going to write a book. I got to have it in 30 days.
The opportunity was given to every member of Congress to show the congressman exactly what was at stake in the North Cascades. And I can't help but think that it had a major impact.
Well, it's Rufus Xavier to this country. All right, yes. And where's your mean typewriter?
After 12 years of effort, Congress created North Cascades National Park.
Without Dave, there wouldn't be a park. He knew the national organization. He knew everybody. And if he decided that there was to be done, he knew what buttons to push and how to push them and get things going.
At the same time as the Sierra Club was defending the North Cascades, there was a stretch of the Colorado River that was still wild. But there was also a man in a powerful position who wanted to change that.
I would develop every possible hydroelectric site all over these United States.
In 1963, the year Glen Canyon Dam was completed, Commissioner of Reclamation Floyd Dominey announced plans to build two more power dams on the Colorado, this time in the Grand Canyon itself. Horrified, Brower attacked. His first weapon was a book of stunning photographs lamenting the death of Glen Canyon and warning that Grand Canyon dams would do irreparable damage to one of the wonders of the world. He sent a copy to Interior Secretary Udall, Floyd Dominey's superior.
I was working for Stuart Udall when the book place nobody knew, arrived, went over the pictures of what was in Glen Canyon, he shook his head and he almost wept and he said, you know, I was in Congress when we voted for this dam. We had no idea what was there.
Boy Dominique countered with a film celebrating the reservoir that replaced Glen Canyon. Johnson and the congressional delegations of every western state. Never had the Sierra Club faced so powerful a foe.
One of the posters this year put out was a poster of Mount Everest. And on the bottom of that poster, I put the little lines from Goethe. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it.
Boldly, with full-page newspaper ads, Brower charged that one of the proposed dams would inundate Grand Canyon National Park.
There is no other Grand Canyon, and Grand Canyon's highest purpose is for it all to be protected, for all people, forever.
Dave Brower deliberately misled the public. He had people believing we were going to have a lake in Grand Canyon National Park up to the brim, and he knew better than that, but he did it.
Technically, Dominique was correct. Most of the flooding would have occurred in areas of the Grand Canyon outside the national park. But the living Colorado, the wild river that dug this chasm, would be silenced forever. Public opposition to the Grand Canyon dams mounted, and when proponents argued that a reservoir in the canyon would offer easier access to its glories, Brower responded with a vengeance. He ran more newspaper ads ridiculing the plan. The result of public protests swamped the Bureau of Reclamation.
It did stampede a lot of people. I'm sure it made many members of Congress reluctant to go against the tons of mail that were flowing in, even though they knew that it was inspired mail from a false point of view.
In the end, Udall declared his opposition to the dams. And in the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River still runs free.
One of the most important things for any public official is to be open-minded. And Brower helped me see things in a different light. And in that sense, I'm in his debt, no question about it.
The Grand Canyon, saved. The North Cascades.
One of Dave Brower's disappointments was that the area here, the Glacier Peak area, was never really included in the national park because the mining companies were still powerful enough and still had the plan at that time to build a Kennecott copper mine, a mine that actually would have been large enough to be seen from the moon in that area. But now that's no longer the case, and one of my hopes is that they might even create the wilderness area here in his honor, since he did so much to protect it and make it possible. Before I go on, anybody have any questions?
I notice you often have do you always have a female narrator for these pieces? Is that intentional, or what's behind that?
No, and you'll see that sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but particularly in a case like this, where it's a biography, an hour long, of one person, in this case a man, who talks through it very much, I thought it certainly would add balance to have a female voice as the narration. And as I look back on my programs over the years, it really comes out almost even the times that I've chosen a female versus a male narrator, and it's had to do often with subject or just my feeling for what was worth at the time. Yes?
I think it's interesting that this story you told seemed like he's a very honorable man with a good conscience that simply wasn't informed about the issue. And when he was informed, he responded wonderfully. And the input of thousands of people made the difference.
It really did.
And I wonder now, in this context, in which people in the administration of our current government, they have very focused intentions. I don't think that they would be so open-minded if we said, let's change the way we manage oil, for example. I mean, it's an obvious one. But again, I think it speaks to the need for people to be vocal, regardless of whether somebody is environmentally open to things or not.
Well, yes, I agree. And I think that Stuart Udall was a unique Secretary of the Interior. I think he was an individual very, very concerned about the environment. He wrote books out and things. He was at one time a congressman representing Arizona who really never did see the Glen Canyon and what was in it before it was dammed. But he did change his mind. Interestingly enough, his brother Mo didn't change his mind. Although late in life, I think, he said that he was mad the dams were never built. But Mo Udall, in fact, got so mad at David Brower for these ads in the New York Times, like the one about flooding the Sistine Chapel, that he succeeded in getting the IRS to take away the Sierra Club's nonprofit tax deductible status over that incident. Now, Mo Udall was like his brother in many ways, and in later years, a much more liberal political figure, even especially when he ran for president, even a few years later. And in later years, I think, look back on this as that it would have been a terrible tragedy had he gotten his way and had the Grand Canyon been flooded. Floyd Dominy has had no such change of heart as you can see in the film.
Which brings me to ask, how did you get Floyd Dominy to speak as freely as he did?
Getting Floyd Dominy to speak is probably the easiest thing any filmmaker. I called him up and said I'd like to interview him for the program, and he invited me out to his ranch, which is in the western part of the state of Virginia, Appalachian foothills. So I came there to do the interview, and before we even did the interview, he told me he wanted to give me a tour of the ranch and show me the 7 dams that he built right on his land. So he showed me. And Floyd Dominy was in remarkable physical condition at his age and everything. And so we sat down after he offered me a drink. Had one himself. I refused until after the interview. We sat down, and Floyd Dominy looked at me and looked at the camera, and he said, "This is TV, right?" And he said, "Yeah." He says, "You want a sound bite, right? You like sound bites." He said, "Yeah." He says, "I'll give you a sound bite." So he looks right at me and says, "I'd build a power dam in every possible site all over the United States." And then he says, "How's that for a soundbite?" It's perfect. You can imagine that. That's the first thing viewers are going to see of you. Because that was just what kind of guy you are, you know. And, you have strong opinions. And Floyd Dominy did have strong opinions. It was interesting. I wondered how he would feel about this show. And a few years later, when a film called Cadillac Desert was being made, the producers called me to get Floyd Dominy's phone number. And one of the producers said, they said, I said, well, you probably shouldn't mention that you got it from me, because that might, after the Brower film, Floyd Dominey might not be a big fan of mine. And later, after they did the film, the producer called me later and said, oh, thanks, you know, and she said, oh, and, you know, we talked about it. She said, Dominey was perfectly happy with the film. He thought you were fair to him, treated him fair, let him say his piece, and he had no problems with the film at all. It was delighted to say exactly the same thing to us. And in fact, if you watch Cadillac Desert, some of what Dominey says is word for word exactly the same as he had said to me about 6-7 years earlier. So he has it down. The second clip I'm going to show you is from a short film that I did that was on PBS recently called On Nature's Terms. And it's really about the importance of preserving habitat and, in some cases, restoring the big, great carnivores, the big predators, the wolves, the grizzly bears, the mountain lions, and so forth, to parts particularly of the Intermountain West and the mountains, but also other areas. And it's about how important these animals actually are to the ecological chain of life, which tends to unravel when the high order predators are no longer there. And one of the things that the key points that the film tried to make is that these animals often migrate in search of food and other kinds of things. And they not only need large land areas that are relatively free of zillions of roads and things like that they can live in, but they also need to be connected in some way with corridors to other large land areas. Because if populations are trapped in certain spaces, in places and interbreed, you can actually have a decrease in the quality of the species and its ability to survive. It's a sort of an inbreeding kind of thing. And so they actually need to really get out. And so the story I'm going to show you is that takes place just outside the city of Los Angeles. And it's a short story about an ordinary woman who felt that she wanted to preserve some land to connect two major wild areas in the Los Angeles basin, so that the bobcats, mountain lions, and other creatures that live there. And I was very surprised, frankly. I did some shooting in the Santa Monica Mountains and in the other mountains around Los Angeles. And if you don't know that or haven't been, it's quite amazing to know just how many big predators actually live in those mountains, and how many people in the suburbs there in the San Fernando Valley kind of look up the hillside and think they're seeing his house cats and they're seeing bobcats and things like that. And coyotes actually walk through suburban neighborhoods. We saw that. But this is about a woman who's sort of determined to save this connection so that she could preserve habitat for the animals.
Necessary for the protection of all predators. But those areas must not be separated from each other as islands in a sea of development. That's a lesson Claire Schlotterbeck learned after she fought to save the open space near her home in Southern California.
This is one of the world's 20 hotspots for biodiversity. There's more variety of life in this region than any region of comparable size in the country, which makes it a hotspot. And it's a hotspot because it's fallen apart, being threatened by development.
Claire lives on the edge of the Chino Hills, grassy rolling country north of the high tree-covered Santa Ana Mountains. The Santa Anas are part of Cleveland National Forest, while the Chino Hills are protected by a state park Claire fought to create back in 1980. 15 million people live within an hour's drive of the area. The state park and national forest are separated by a busy freeway. and by this deep arroyo called Coal Canyon. For wildlife, Coal Canyon provides what ecologists call connectivity, the corridor between large protected open spaces.
And they all use this river of life to flow from the big, large open space of the Pueblo National Forest to Chino Hills State Park and beyond.
A few years ago, a major housing project was planned for the lower part of Coal Canyon. Biologist Paul Beyer and park ranger Gary Hunt warned conservationists that the development would block predator migration, dooming mountain lions and bobcats, and threatening the entire ecosystem.
It made me realize that everything I'd worked for the last 20 years as a volunteer in establishing Chino Hills State Park was at risk, and that unless we connected Coal Canyon to the Cleveland National Forest, everything I'd spent 20 years working on would be gone.
So Claire looked for a way to stop the proposed subdivision. She persuaded other people to come and see Coal Canyon and join with her in the effort to save it.
And we formed a very big coalition to help stop the development and purchase the land. But it was very expensive land because it was entitled and ready to build.
In fact, they had to raise $50 million to buy the land. They got it from individuals, corporations, municipalities, foundations, and the state park system.
But we had to fight for every dollar.
November 2000. Claire Schlotterbeck and her fellow activists celebrate victory as Coal Canyon is officially added to Chino Hills State Park, guaranteeing that predators will always have a corridor between the hills and the high Santa Anas. Citizen action to save the canyon was a resounding success. Perhaps more importantly, it was a victory for the principle of connectivity.
And it redefined state parks' priorities. State parks, because now they're the first state agency to get it. They understand that all the state parks they've saved are at risk unless they connect them to other large open spaces.
And I hope it can serve as a real inspiring example to say, okay, let's look at the map. Where do we go next?
We need to set aside more land now. It's never going to get any cheaper. By any standard, 50 years from now, the land that we would buy today is cheap. You often hear from politicians that there's no money to do these kinds of things. There is money for anything we place priority upon. Even in the inner cities, they're saying we want more parks. We want places to recreate. We're worried about the mental health of our children. We're worried about the discipline and the delinquency problems of our children. And we see parks, we see refuges and wildlife areas to take our children, to teach them different values than they learn in a concrete jungle.
We're going to play a predator-prey game right now.
So it's the kind of thing that probably many of you may know that of places, even locally or in your area, where this kind of activism or awareness could be important in saving some of this land for future generations, and particularly for the biodiversity and the wildlife who that live there. Any questions about this one?
Where does that cut across the 91 freeway?
It goes from Whittier to Riverside. It's okay. The Riverside freeway.
Because the 91's about one of the busiest out of LA, and I just, those animals are probably killed getting across there.
Animals that try to cross the freeway frequently, but there is a big, what they've done is put this big thing underneath, big opening under the freeway. Okay. The animals really use it. Yeah. So they do that.
It'd be interesting that our Senate office is about a mile from that.
Here,
our Senate office for Pacifica is about a mile from Coal Canyon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really close.
Wow, I wonder if the church was involved at all in that.
I don't know. Don't ask.
To say that, don't ask. Okay, I'm not asking. I didn't ask. You didn't hear me ask.
No.
Yes.
I just finished Barbara Kingsolver's The Prodigal Summer, which I think is just a really excellent work of fiction in terms of biodiversity. And I mean, and I keep thinking, how possible is it ever for something like that to be made into a movie that tells a story as well as really communicates? And she's a biologist as well as a...
Now that's a novel, right?
It's a novel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh yeah, well I think it's even easier in a way as a novel to, yeah. And of course her books are very, very popular, but have any of them been...
No.
It's interesting that they haven't been yet made into films, because they certainly, many of them have been extremely popular books. Yeah. That one I haven't read. Let's see what this is. Barbara Kingsolver.
It's very ecological. I mean, she deals with the coyote as the predator, and it's extremely, I think, educational, but also a story. So.
One real inspiring thing was we went around the country and we saw some of these stories, and one of the inspiring things was to meet a rancher and talk to her and do a story in the piece about her, who lives just outside Bozeman, Montana. And she determined that she wasn't going to, I mean, she first was ranching there, and coyotes would take the sheep that she raised. She would call what's called wildlife services, and they would basically come in and shoot the coyote or poison the coyote or do something like that, which was the standard practice. And she finally decided, you know, she didn't want to do that anymore, that she really wanted us to try to raise sheep in what was called a predator-friendly fashion, in which, they wouldn't harm the predators. They would use other kinds of non-lethal means to protect the sheep. And they ended up getting llamas. And the coyotes are strangely afraid of the llamas. They've never really experienced this animal, which is a very large animal. And the llamas are, the coyotes would come around the sheep and the llamas kind of coyotes. Now, she still has a little problem from black bears who aren't terrified by the llamas. but her losses to coyotes have been decreased enormously, and she's finding that she can be very successful in actually raising these animals without destroying the predators. Mm-hmm.
I think when you talk about changing the way things are, in Oregon they changed the law where you cannot hunt mountain lions with dogs any longer. What has happened is they've seen such an increase in the mountain lion population, particularly when I worked down southwestern Oregon, that now they're having a problem with mountain lions. So if you upset that natural balance between one to the other, to the other, to the other, then you have problems too.
Well, we have had a similar situation in Washington State, but it's a complex thing, because part of the increase in the problem with mountain lions has also been the fact that their natural habitat in many ways has been decreased and has pushed them nearer to human habitation. So it sometimes appears that the population has grown immensely as a result. And this is a hotly debated issue, and I don't frankly know the right answer. I don't want to judge it. I mean, some other folks. Susan is a biologist and probably deals with this a lot. What do you think about that?
Well, it's hard. We've changed the balance, and yet we're building homes in their habitat. So you're right, but so we have human problems. But one of the positive things is learning how to have, just like we're making defensible space for fires, we need to have defensible space for predators. Don't store your dog food outside. Don't have small children outside on the table. You know, it's sort of like proactive behaviors that'll minimize the contact. But it is a local problem. Levelmore and Tenasca, our area here. This summer, it hasn't been in the paper as much, but last summer we had several encounters.
How many people were killed?
Yeah, nobody was killed.
How many people were killed by drunk drivers?
On average, about one half of one person per year have been killed by mountain lions in the United States. Far fewer people are killed by these large predators than are killed by bee stings or light muskrats. In fact, so your chances of really being the victim of one of these predators are pretty small. They're a little bit higher with a mountain lion than with a wolf. I'm going to show you now. In this area, long before we entered the Pacific Northwest, the native peoples were living here probably for 10 to 20,000 years, and developed something of a land ethic, and we don't want to overly romanticize this or act like it was perfect in any way, but today, in particularly in Western Washington State, the tribes have played a very key role on a whole host of environmental issues in terms of trying to protect the environment, and in terms of habitat for salmon, forests, many other things. The Native American groups have been at the forefront of the groups trying to fight for environmental protection. And they do have still, I think, some connection that we don't and haven't with these culturally, with the natural ecosystems. And so I'm going to show you a clip from a film called Moon's Prayer. The Moon's Prayer is sort of a Northwest folk tale that they talk about in the longhouses in the Pacific Northwest. They tell to kids, and the prayer goes something like this. If you look at the full moon at night, you'll see this sort of dark, shadowy shape, which they say is the shape of an Indian kind of kneeling with two feathers over like this, and the Indian is kneeling in prayer, and the Indian is praying to the Great Spirit to protect the earth and the people of the earth. So the segment that I'm going to show you is about the old growth timber issue and the role that a couple of members of the Lummi tribe near Bellingham have played in trying to protect our old growth timber, which we of course lost about 90 to 95% of. And I think it has an interesting approach to the spirituality as well.
Is not the only struggle facing contemporary Northwest Indians. The wood in this 600-year-old cedar tree is worth thousands of dollars, so the tree is being cut down. Such trees are now scarce.
And we were asked to put together some canoes for the 100-year centennial of the state. We had a difficult time finding cedar trees large enough to make canoes out of. Told one of the timber boys that we couldn't find a tree big enough to sit in.
Today, timber industry practices show greater environmental awareness than those of the past. But some Indian leaders believe more change is needed.
Everything down here is logged. Motor Creek is 100% lost because they clear cut all above it and get it into the creek hole.
Ken Cooper of the Lummi tribe monitors timber harvesting along the forks of the Nooksack River near the Canadian border.
Yeah. Right now today they're clear cutting the Rainbow Creek, which is all on a stable slope.
Cooper and fellow Lummi activist Jewel James oppose continued clear cutting on hillsides like this one above the Nooksack. They take their concerns on the road, stopping to speak with local residents.
And so when we started seeing this happen on this side of the dike, we were very upset about it.
It's pretty hard to do anything to stop them, but It doesn't take a genius to figure out what that's going to do to that river.
James and Cooper have seen salmon streams destroyed when heavy rains cause mudslides on clear-cut slopes. They believe in selective cutting, leaving enough trees standing to hold the soil.
Economically, we all pay when you have clear cuts. And when you have high mountainous areas such as we have here in the Northwest, you have a lot of unstable slopes. And it's just a matter of time and weather, those slopes are going to give way.
We've got a mile and a half, but this is actual land that used to be up in the mountain. We got 1 mile and a half of land that wasn't here before.
Cooper says sediments, eroding from clear-cut hillsides, are carried by the Nooksack into Bellingham Bay.
And as a child, we'd go out of here about a half mile down and dig clams. Now there's nothing there but sawdust and silt.
The Nooksack River begins here in Cascade Mountain snowfields.
The mountain range is presumably fast, or limited deep and great. The rivers and streams that all along through this mountain range we use for spiritual bathing, and each area has a different kind of a gift for traditional people. There's lots of medicine and all the plant life that the Creator put here.
We still believe it is the Garden of Eden.
There's a lot of people in the cities that will never ever enjoy this forest, but that does not mean that they or their children do not have a right to come here someday and experience some of nature in its finest.
Along the Nooksack, Jewel James and Ken Cooper still follow the spiritual path of their ancestors. Their temples are the old-growth forests, worth more, they say, to the spirit in this artificial age than they will ever be worth as lumber on the market.
Some of these trees are just saplings when Columbus landed here. So these trees are full of knowledge. They've seen lots in their time, and they've got lots to offer for people like us. When we come and sit beneath these trees, we ask them for some of their power, ask them for some of their knowledge. This is our way of life, where we're standing. This is where we come and practice and talk. We talk to these trees. You take the drum and you listen to this background noise of the river. You hold it in your hand and start imitating what you're hearing. And you'll pick up a song.
In his spare time, Jewel James fashions art from antlers, gifts from Indian hunters who don't want to waste any part of the animal. His inspiration is the magic of nature.
I cannot force the piece to be something other than it is. I really believe that. I think it's got its own spirituality about it. But it also symbolizes the relationship of humankind's connectedness to the other animals, the other spirits in the world around us. Here we have a killer whale with a salmon in it, and a wolf up here, and two more killer whales, raven and the sun. Part of this magic is actually dying today.
Show one more clip, and this is kind of a positive story, I think, of change in the forest, coming all too slowly, but nonetheless coming, and something that you can begin to think about as you go back home about how little acts of consuming, for instance, purchasing. Can make a difference for the environment and also for indigenous people. And that's the issue of certified wood. How many people here have heard of certified wood? We've got a few, okay. Certified wood is like fair trade or shade grown coffee. It's a labeling system to indicate to a consumer that the wood has been harvested in a way that is ecologically sustainable and also in a way that has been fair to people doing the work and with concern for the communities of people who live in the area. And the major certifier in the world today, the most stringent certifier, is an organization called the Forest Stewardship Council. It's headquartered internationally in Oaxaca, Mexico, and also has offices in Washington, D.C., and sends people out around the world to various forest operations to certify those which practice good forestry principles, sustainable forestry principles. There are not, as you might imagine, too many of them. The only place bright light in all of this is Sweden, where now about half of the forests have been certified, and more are continually being certified. In the United States, the figure is 1%, so we have a ways to go. In Europe, generally, it's about 15. And there's much more knowledge in Europe of all of this kind of labeling, which helps us as consumers play a role in the global market in a fair trade fashion to help the market do a little bit more of the right things than it might otherwise do if it was left completely on its own. The story that I'm going to show you is it's a work in progress. I'm actually working on a longer piece about the whole issue of certified wood and of ecological and social labeling. But the three segments you're going to see are about three forestry operations in the United States that are actually practicing a much more sustainable form of logging. And I think when you see this FSC label, if you are going to places, stores like Home Depot, Lowe's, and others have made a commitment to taking as much certified wood as they can possibly get. They were pressured into this, of course, by activists from the Rainforest Action Network and other groups who held great protests at their stores and put banners up and down and things like that. But nonetheless, they have made this commitment and they are trying to get this wood. And it's something to think about if you're going into one of these places and buying some wood for remodeling or anything else, to look for this FSC label. So I'll show you just a little of this.
Uses for certification were set for the Forest Stewardship Council, an international organization based in Oaxaca, Mexico. An FSC logo on a product means the forest it comes from meets the most stringent worldwide standards blending social, environmental, and economic needs.
And what we want to ensure is that workers are being treated fairly and the community's interests are really being taken into account. We're really looking at the viability of the company. Are they really shortchanging the local community, the environment, at the expense of some type of short economic return?
The customer, the end user, can really feel confident when they see that FSC trademark on the lumber or whatever product they're buying.
Jay Francis is the forest manager for Collins Pine Corporation, the first FSC-certified timber company in the United States.
The overall objective is to leave the stand in better growing condition after we finish our harvesting process than it was when we started.
Collins foresters selectively harvest trees from diversified stands of pine, fir, and cedar. They've been through here several times, but you never know it by the looks of the forest.
The trees range in age all the way from zero all the way up to about 350 years old. We've got some old growth trees on just about every acre of the forest. The trees that we leave provide the seed base.
They also leave snags, logs, and woody debris for wildlife, and they carefully protect watersheds. When Collins bought this forest in 1941, it contained 1.5 billion board feet of wood. Since then, the company has harvested 2 billion board feet. Yet 1.5 billion still remains in the forest. That's brought respect and praise from environmentalists and from other forest product companies.
I, in the end, need all my peers being able to work in a forest like this. I feel like I have the best job in the world. I feel extremely blessed to work for a company who not only expects, but demands that we take good care of the forest.
Don Hansen feels the same way. He works down the road from Common Spine for the world's largest supplier of plywood.
I see myself as a logger and an environmentalist. I love the environment enough to where I made it my life's work. And I feel the two are compatible.
Roseburg's California forest is also FSC certified. It wasn't easy because company foresters had used herbicides to restore fire-damaged lands. The certifiers required justification.
They didn't feel that herbicide use was compatible with a lot of their ideas of sustainable forest management. But after looking at the problems, they realized that some prudent and judicious use of herbicide could be tolerated. Good forest management will satisfy almost all of the requirements of certification. So it isn't anything that we have to fear.
Marshall Tecor agrees. As chief forester for the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, Tecor has had frequent meetings with certifiers.
I think it's usually a time of lively discussion about new principles, new ideas. Ideas that we sometimes thought about that maybe we kind of dragged our feet on. Certification has kind of given us the push to move forward with these things.
Certification is new for the Menominees, but they take pride in 140 years of sustainable forest practices. When timber barons left the rest of Wisconsin's forest in shambles, the Menominees managed their timber so they would always have something to cut.
What Menominee really represents is that you can manage a large resource, take commodities, derive income from it, and still have a pristine looking forest, clean air, clean water, and spiritual feeling from the forest. And we got more timber now than when we started.
The forest and the Menominee Lumber Mill also provide jobs for many tribal members.
Every year the value that we get, the dollars and cents that we get from being certified is increasing.
At the annual Menominee Powwow, colorfully dressed dancers wind among beautiful pine trees. Around them, the tribe's certified forest stands tall and pristine.
There is old people come back that have left, and so we still got a forest now. Yeah.
In Minnesota, discussions between timber managers and environmentalists have led to widespread certification of public land.
I would say about 30% of the county land is being certified, and then the next 2 to 3 years, more than half of the land probably will be certified over that time period. Every meeting I go to, certification at the national and local level is an issue, and people are moving towards it. Public agencies are moving toward it.
That's good news to...
Certification issue is an interesting one here in the Northwest, in the sense that there are debates and battles over this even within the same company. To give you an example, in about 2 years ago, Weyerhaeuser Timber, the big Washington State company, which of course went through the Midwest before coming out here, bought the British Columbia company Macmillan Bloedel, which had at one point been notorious for kind of clear-cutting places where on Vancouver Island and on the mainland. And in the early to mid-90s, there were huge protests against Macmillan Bloedel in Canada, all kinds of arrests, all kinds of activity. And The company responded, and Mac Blow, as they call them, decided that they were going to change their practices, and actually on all of their other timberlands, which they leased from the Crown, from the government of Canada, they would try to get FSC certified, and they would begin to use completely sustainable practices based on the 10 key FSC principles. And they succeeded in a rather short time in doing so as they changed their practices. Well, 2 years ago, Weyerhaeuser completely bought Macmillan Bloedel, and now Macmillan Bloedel is called the BC Coastal Group of Weyerhaeuser. But Macmillan Bloedel, that group had agreed to a long-term FSC certification process with the environmentalists, and they know that if they were to suddenly change their practices, the environmentalists would be out there again, and we would have all the same arrests and conflict and so forth. So you have, on the one hand, within the Weyerhaeuser Corporation, the BC unit strongly endorsing certification and moving in that direction. You have the Washington unit doing precisely the opposite and doing everything it can on a national level to fight the Forest Stewardship Council, to the extent that up until 2 years ago, the government of in Washington State, the state government and the Natural Resources Department was doing the same thing that Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and New York, among other states, were doing. That is, beginning to try to move toward large-scale certification of state timberlands. Then we elected a new commissioner of public lands 2 years ago, and went from a Democrat to a Republican. And basically, the first thing that the new public lands commissioner did was drop the certification action because Weyerhaeuser got in and said, you know, basically, we don't want this. So it's a conflict, and it's something you now that you've seen something about it, you may see more. And it's not perfect. Things like FSC, all of these things are far from perfect, but they're steps in the right direction that allow us as consumers to have a little bit more say about what happens to the people and to the land from our consumption practices. Any other questions?
I'm not that familiar with Washington. We came across 20, like where Republic is, that town, and there was some clear cutting there.
Oh yeah, well, we still have a lot of clear cutting here.
So I wonder, is there a lot of clear cutting?
Yeah. If you go through Snoqualmie Pass you will see, you know, large examples of clear cutting on both private and public lands.
I have a question. Up here. I'll find out.
Oh, okay.
How much of the impetus for the certification program is consumer driven? That is, you've got, you mentioned Home Depot and others, but you know, you've got all kinds of lumber companies. Do they take an interest in this? I mean, if contractors are coming in asking for certified lumber, are they, for one thing? Does that make a difference? And
yes, I think it does. And I mean, I think there is growing interest among the companies. There's also a competing certification program called the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, SFI, and you may see their logos in places too. And that was really initiated by Weyerhaeuser and by the American Wood and Paper Association as kind of an alternative, which is much less stringent as you might expect. But the pressure from FSC and the number of people who are going, particularly internationally, to the FSC label is forcing even the industry standard to get better, I mean, to improve. And I think the more support there is for FSC, the more that it'll be driven in that direction. But it's still small. I mean, the companies here are still smaller companies. Collins Pine, which is really, many of you who may come from Oregon, from Portland, are probably aware that this is a company that has a pretty good reputation in many, many areas. They give a lot to the community. It's a smaller company, and it's always had from the family, from the founder, the idea that it really owes a it owes something back to the land and the workers and the communities in which it operates. And so Collins Pine had no problem getting certified just based on the practices they've been following. It's sort of interesting that these things create some complex situations. In California, there was an initiative that old growth activists were trying to get on the California ballot for this year. They didn't succeed in getting the signatures, but it was called the Heritage Trees Initiative. And the idea behind it was that you couldn't cut any trees that were standing before California became a state in 1850, or any tree that was over a certain diameter, say 30 inches for some species, 36 for others, or any tree that was within 50 feet of any tree that met those characteristics. Mm-hmm. Now, the irony of this, and it's sort of one of these laws that sounds very good in principle, instead of drawing a line in the sand, but it may have had precisely the opposite impact. Because a company like Collins Pine, which has actually done a good job and selectively harvests some old growth trees when the trees show signs of disease or have other problems, and has tons of old growth all over their land, would basically be forced to stop harvesting at all. And the people who have already clear cut and slashed out their land and everything can kind of go on in their merry way. And the companies also that don't really care about the public, the Pacific Lumber companies of the world and so forth, are probably the ones who would be likely to cut the tree down right before it reached the 30 inches or the 36 inches. So these issues of forest management are complicated, but I think it's something for us to think about. How our products that we consume are made, and because clearly, even though I made the film Affluenza and I'm talking about decreasing consumption, that doesn't mean we're going to stop consuming. We have to build houses. We have to do things like that, and we can do it in a more sustainable way if we're aware of what goes into these things. I was going to show that we don't have the time. Now, and I will do it in the food thing because it could be in this forum, but also in the Thursday food thing, a clip from a film called Genetic Time Bomb. And it's actually a story of scientists who actually starved to death to save seeds in Russia during the Second World War. And I thought about showing it in this program because I was thinking of the whole story from Noah and from Genesis of how Noah was took two from every kind of animal and put them in the ark, and that these were not just the useful animals. It said, I don't remember the exact words now, but all the animals, whether these were seen as pests or problems or whatever, but. I think a friend of mine, Cal DeWitt, who some of you may know, who's a theologian and also an environmental scientist teaching at the University of Wisconsin, interesting combination, used this. He spoke to Congress to try to get them to continue the Endangered Species Act, and he actually spoke to some of the religious conservative members of Congress and used this example and said that this was really a lesson about the importance of biodiversity, that all these species in the system matter, it's not just the domesticated animals that are useful to us, but it's all part of creation, and that played a role in actually the fact that Congress didn't overturn the Endangered Species Act. But this piece, which I will show in the food section on Thursday, is about how we're losing biodiversity around the world in agriculture and seeds and so forth, and the necessity of really saving this stuff before it's lost, because it could have terrible implications for feeding people in the future. I think that's about all I have today. Tomorrow, if you're interested, I'm going to do the program is called Live Simply That Others May Simply Live. And many people have seen Affluenza, so I probably won't show anything from Affluenza, but I'm going to show some a couple of clips from the follow-up program to Affluenza, Escape from Affluenza, which was really stories of people who were changing and simplifying their lives. And then I'm going to show a clip from another documentary of mine called Running Out of Time, which is about our time-pressed, overworked American society. And I want to talk a little bit about a big project that I'm working on today about the whole issue of overwork in America and its multiple negative impacts on all kinds of aspects of our society, from health to families to citizenship, communities, and the spirit, I think. So anyway, if there's any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, thank you all for being here.